For Radio Autonomía, this is a special interview with activist scholar John Holloway. During his recent visit to San Francisco, where he presented a three-part lecture series titled After Capitalism, we had the opportunity to meet with John to talk a bit about the meaning of revolution and autonomous struggle today.
My name is John Holloway. I live in Mexico. I've been living in Mexico for more than 20 years, and I work there as a professor in the Institute of Social Sciences and Humanities in the Autonomous University of Puebla. And I think I enjoy working there a lot because I think that our general feeling in the Institute, or certainly in the section I'm in, is that really the meaning of scientific work, the meaning of education, is really thinking how we can stop this dreadful rush towards destruction that capitalism means. And I think if we think of education in that context, or if we think of research in that context, then it acquires a meaning. Mm.
So we were really interested in hearing a little bit about, your most recent book, Crack Capitalism, where you describe cracks as the perfectly, this is a quote from you, the perfectly ordinary creation of a space or moment in which we assert a different type of doing. You know, and this really emphasizes the power of ordinary people and ordinary spaces in the resistance against capitalism, in the kind of everyday, in the here and the now. So getting away from a sort of spectacular focus on revolution with a capital R, right? So we were curious if you could talk a little bit about perhaps some concrete examples of where you've seen this in action, and why you think it's particularly useful to think about struggle in this way.
Well, I think what we're all involved in some sort of way is actually rethinking. I mean, as I said a moment ago, thinking about how on earth we can stop the headlong rush towards destruction that capitalism means. And I think that really means rethinking the whole concept of revolution, rethinking the whole concept of resistance and rebellion. And one point that seems to me very important is just to give up this old idea that there is something very special about being anti-capitalist, or there's something very special about being revolutionary. That I think if we live in the society that we live in, you know, if we see what's happening, I mean, just a moment ago you were telling me about the police repression in Oakland and San Francisco, you were telling me about the foreclosures. I mean, I remember reading that in the United States for the last, well, 3 or 4 years, the annual number of foreclosures is something like 1 million a year. I mean, that still seems to me an absolutely unbelievable figure. But if you think, well, that, you know, that's where we live, that's really what capitalism means, is this constant aggression against people. In that situation, we all are inevitably, I think, in some sense, anti-capitalist. You know, just to live in a society where, in a society based on repression, makes it impossible not to react against that oppression in some way. And that reaction, of course, may take the form of getting involved in radical politics. Lots of times it doesn't. It just takes the form of thinking, well, you know, really we shouldn't let that sort of thing continue. Or it takes the form of trying to construct spaces of decency in a way within the family or within the home or with your friends or with your colleagues at work. But I think we're all involved, or practically all involved, in some sort of pushing in the opposite direction. you know, where we say, look, that's not the sort of society we want. We don't want a society that is just built on money and the logic of profit. We have to try and construct something else. And this is what I think I mean when I talk about cracks, that we're trying to create spaces or moments that walk in the wrong direction, that spaces or moments where we actually create a different way of relating to one another. And sometimes these spaces or these cracks are very spectacular. I mean, since I live in Mexico, I think a lot of the Zapatistas, for example, you know, there they've got this spectacular crack that's been going for, well, publicly now for almost 20 years, where they say, you know, here in our territory, the bad government should stay out. Here the people rule. Here we will construct our own way. Here we are constructing our own way of doing things, our own way of administering the society. Here we are creating our own system of education, our own system of healthcare. Here, we are creating something else here and now. And that's what I mean by a crack. But of course, it doesn't have to be so spectacular. It could just be a group of friends coming together, at, you know, when they leave university or when they finish school, and they think, well, we don't really want to devote our lives to just producing profit for some company that means nothing at all to us. We're going to try and do something with our lives that makes sense to us. You know, so they get together and they decide to go off in some other direction. And the other direction may be crazy. Maybe, you know, for people looking at them, they may be just mad. It may be unrealistic, but at least they're trying to create some sort of different way of doing things, some sort of different way of constructing society. So that can be thought of as a kind of little crack. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to think of that, then I think you look around and you see, in fact, no, the world is full of cracks. The world is absolutely full of people trying to create something else, something in a different way. No?
And could I ask a follow-up question? Mm-hmm. Can you talk about maybe whether it's important that there be a kind of coordination between these cracks? Because that's the kind of sort of view of revolution from before, is that, well, you need something to coordinate all of these together, because otherwise they're sort of isolated and dispersed and perhaps find themselves isolated. So to what extent do you think that coordination between those is something that needs to happen or doesn't? Maybe it doesn't need to happen, but...
Yeah, I think there has to be, well, or it's desirable, rather, that there should be some sort of mutual recognition of the cracks. Or it's desirable that there should be some sort of flowing together, some sort of confluence between the cracks. You know, that we should recognize different forms of opposition, different forms of trying to create something different, even if we don't necessarily agree with them, even if we don't necessarily think that's the best way to go, that we should recognize the validity of people setting out to do something else, to do something that runs counter to the current system. So I tend to think in terms of the links between these cracks, in terms of resonances. Mm-hmm. And I think these resonances can be created in all sorts of ways. They can be created just through conversations. They can be created through radio programs like this. They can be created through songs. They can be created towards... it can be created through meetings or doing things together, sharing a demonstration, whatever. What I don't really think helps at all is some sort of institutional coordination. You know, the institutional coordination may be well-intentioned. It is not necessarily harmful, though I think that the effect on the whole is that it kind of makes the whole proceeding, the whole movement a bit boring, you know, that doesn't help very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Crack Capitalism was published in 2010, before the rise of the Occupy movement in the United States, which we could think of as an important moment in the making of cracks. And here, with Occupy Oakland on one side, we saw social barriers dissolved and new ways of relating arise. On the other side, we saw the reemergence of divisions based on power, class, and race dynamics. How do cracks produce new social fabrics?
I think of cracks as spaces of moments of negation and creation. In other words, a crack is saying, no, we will not accept what is happening. We will not accept the current system of domination. We will create something else. So it's not just a no. It's also the attempt to actually create something else through, I don't know, creating an Occupy movement or creating an alternative radio program, creating, I don't know, a communal kitchen, creating a community garden. So it's the idea of saying no and trying to create something else. The thing is that these movements are always contradictory, I think, because on the one hand, we want to create a new world. On the other hand, our feet are still stuck in the mud of the existing world. So there's kind of a contradiction there in what we do ourselves. And part of the, we can't expect these movements to be perfect. They never are. I mean, the contradictions of the existing system will always kind of reproduce themselves within the movement to some extent. And all we can do, I think, is constantly be aware of those dangers and try and guard against them and try and talk them through and think them through and see how we avoid them. But we don't have any easy answers.
Yeah, and I think that this goes back to what you mentioned about the sort of risks of institutionalized coordination or rather than a sort of more organic resonances. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is something that we saw with the sort of escalating debates around identity politics in Occupy Oakland. It was so much contention around the name, right? And who gets to claim that name, right? And who gets to be part of that, anti-systemic pseudo-institution. So I think that's precisely an example of sort of what you were pointing to before. But thinking about this question of resonance, the Zapatista movement has obviously had tremendous resonance around the world. Here in the global north, in big quotes, we've seen Zapatista-inspired groups and collectives really struggle with the process of going beyond sort of traditional notions of solidarity, right? Trying to find ways to actually sort of engage that resonance rather than follow a model or reproduce the kind of dynamics of North-South solidarity that we've seen in other historical periods. So we're curious about this idea of an urban zapatismo as a way to think about going beyond solidarity, right? A way to be thinking about working and building alongside and with inspiration from the Zapatistas, right? So we wanted to hear a little bit about to what extent you think this is possible, particularly in the global north, and particularly given the recent communiques from the EZLN that really mark a shift in that dynamic of engagement with, non-Zapatistas or Zapatistas outside of Chiapas or civil society or any kind of category that you could come up with to differentiate between those who live in municipal, autonomous municipalities and the rest of us who find ourselves sort of walking with the Zapatistas.
Okay, I think the Zapatista, the Zapatistas have always said they don't want to be a model. It doesn't make sense to think of them as a model. And they've also, I think, said from the beginning, they've thrown themselves or their own action as a challenge to us, to us who live in the cities or to us who live in different places. Now, I remember there was one lovely interview of Marcus right in the early stages by an Italian journalist, and the Italian journalist asked them at the end, well, what do you want to say to people in Italy? You know, how can they help you? How can they help you here in Chiapas? And Marcos replies, well, the best way they can help is to make their own revolution, to rise up themselves. And when we finish sort things out here in Chiapas, we'll come over and help them. You know? So I think it's all the time it's been that. It's been kind of saying, well, we're not asking for your solidarity. We are challenging you to rise up and proclaim your dignity, proclaim your refusal of oppression. So I think that is what Zapatismo means to me. It's really kind of trying to think what dignity means, or what in whatever setting we happen to live in. Now, I think the Occupy movement is a very clear example of that. I mean, it's a very clear example of saying, well, dignity means that Oakland is ours. Mm-hmm. No, we will occupy Oakland because Oakland is ours. You know, not because we're taking it from anybody else, but because we refuse to have Oakland taken from us. Yeah. And that just seems to be such a simple, obvious statement. I mean, of course. You know, how dare they? How dare they take the world from us? How dare they take the place where we live? How dare they take it away from us? How dare they subject us to rules that have nothing to do with us? How dare they sell us to the highest bidder? No. And that for me is kind of, you know, saying, yes, we say that. We understand that the world is ours because we have the dignity to see the world as ours, because we refuse to be humiliated, because you refuse to be objectified. And you can say, well, that's one thing in a rural context, like in Chiapas, and another thing in the city. And I think that's true. I mean, I think that in the rural context, they have clearer, longer established communities with their own traditions. They also have access to land. They're able to produce their own food, not an awful lot of it, but enough to live on. In the cities, that's much more difficult. But I think what we have seen really over the last about 15, 20 years is really really quite a number of very important uprisings where people are proclaiming their dignity and trying to occupy, or occupying for at least for a period, their own cities. I mean, if you think of Buenos Aires in 2001, if you think of Oaxaca in 2006, where the people occupied the city of Oaxaca for 5 months, and the governor fled, and all the functionaries fled, and the police couldn't operate in the city for 5 months. If you think of the Occupy movements, if you think of, movements, I think, were more difficult. I mean, if you think of Athens in 2008, if you think of Athens again in 2011, if you think of Spain repeatedly over the last couple of years, it's people rising up and saying, how dare you? How dare you try and do that? And really occupying and saying, occupying not in the sense of successfully taking over everything, but in the sense of laying claim to their own country, or laying claim to their own city, laying claim to their own lives. And I think it's that, and as well, the creation. I mean, this is happening as well on an ever-growing scale, certainly in Europe, certainly in Greece and Spain. The creation of groups of self-help, of community gardens, of groups that establish different relationships with agricultural producers, of social centres of all sorts of types. you know, so urban Zapatism is on the move.
This kind of actually relates to our next question. In your work, you analyze the ways the state is characterized by its separation from society and everyday life, which effectively externalizes power. How do you see the relationship between autonomous movements and the state evolving in Latin America, as well as in the global north? And thinking in particular of the anti-austerity movements in Europe and Occupy here in the United States, and what new antagonisms do you think might be emerging?
I think one really important area of conflict at the moment is clearly Southern Europe. Now, I mean, Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Cyprus now, and really how. Where the violence of capitalism has made itself explicit through the imposition of austerity policies that really could not have been imagined even a few years ago. And the huge upsurge of anger, the huge upsurge of refusal of different types. I mean, I suppose that's really the interesting thing, is that it's kind of a traditional state center demonstrations and anger and refusals. And it's also a wave of autonomous struggles, again, of refusal and anger. And the state simply refuses to budge. The state doesn't, you know, I mean, this is an amazing thing, I suppose, one of the features of the present crisis, just the absolute separation between governments and the people, between governments and movements of protest. I mean, governments just don't listen anymore. They don't even pretend to listen. You know, whereas 20, 30 years ago, I think they pretended to listen much more, you know, or perhaps did listen even a little bit. You know, now I think it's just absolute, total closure. And I think that leaves us with the situation with a lot of questions. You know, that if you look at Greece, for example, where it looked possible that Syriza, the left wing, I mean, the left wing party might win in the last election, but the radically left wing party might win in the last election. You can say, well, if they had won, would it really have made any difference? And I suspect it wouldn't, that they would have been forced. They would have made some degree of difference, but they would have been forced simply by their position within the context of the international flow of money. They would have been forced to implement austerity policies in one way or another. So you can say, well, that's not the way. That doesn't provide any solution. And then you look at the kind of terrific struggles to create other ways of doing things, terrific expressions of anger, burning of the center of Athens, no, in some of the demonstrations. And I think what we're forced to do at the moment is think, well, that hasn't given us the answer either. I mean, maybe, you know, I think they're going in the right direction, but we do not, you know, we're faced with a dilemma where we can say, well, of course it's not state-centered politics that's going to change things. We have to create social relations of a different type. And we are doing it. But we're not yet at a stage where we can do it enough to solve the crisis. I mean, the only solution to the crisis, obviously, being to get rid of capitalism. No? We're forced, I think, to think, well, is this the right direction to go? I think it is. But also, how do we make ourselves stronger? How do we actually gather strength to the point where we can say, to hell with capitalism. Get out, capital. We don't want you. that's where we have to get to.
And that clearly seems to be the emerging cry around the world, is to hell with capitalism, in really much more explicit terms than I think we had seen ever before. You know, capitalism is the term that is actually emerging in sort of popular vocabulary, which I think was one of the things that was most striking about Occupy, was to see that it was an anti-capitalist movement in the mainstream in the U.S., where most people sort of assume that capitalism is just this natural order of things.
Colonialism was at one point, too.
But I think, because you were asking about the contradictions, in a way you have to think, well, yes, that's right, and that's what's happening, and that's terrific, but also it's bound to be contradictory. Because if you're finding it difficult to live, if you're, you know, and see yourself with no prospect of employment, and you're bound to be torn between saying, on the one hand, you know, to hell with capitalism, because that there is no way that capitalism is going to solve our problems. There's no way that within capitalism we can make things substantially better. Okay, so there's that feeling on the one hand. There's also the need to get to, in the short term, there's the need to get try and find a job or try and find some way of earning money. So you're kind of cut by this contradiction, inevitably. You know, and that's going to express itself within the movement, I think. And it's a question then of how you think that through. How do you try and process that, but in realistic ways?
So, you know, clearly something that I think we've seen both in the Zapatista movement and all these autonomous movements around the world has been the centrality of education, of alternative education projects. So we'd love to hear a little bit more about the space of the Universidad de la Tierra Puebla, which we don't know if you could comment a little bit about that. You know, we've been in dialogue here from the Bay Area with Unitierra Oaxaca specifically. We have the emerging Unitierra Califas here, and are sort of through the radio and through other projects really continually thinking through this place of, you know, sort of alternative learning spaces as part of building something different, of building different relations, of building different tools, which the radio, we hope, functions as part of.
Yeah, I think the Unitierra in Puebla is very important, but it's still getting off the ground. It's playing a very important role at the moment in the struggle against mining projects, the struggle to build dams and things like that. There are kind of seven in the state of Puebla at the moment. There are seven mega projects, as they're called, which are really projects of death, you know, that'll completely destroy the communities they're being imposed on. So that there have been very important struggles against these projects, and Unitierra has played a very important role there. In the question of alternative education, yes, I think the Unitierra movement, both in Oaxaca and Puebla and California and the other places where it exists or is getting off the ground, I think that's very important. But I think it actually goes much further. Alternative education goes much further. I mean, one of my favorite examples is a place I was at last Saturday, in fact, in the Sierra de Puebla, in a village called Tepeshachuca, which is a project of alternative education that's been going for, I think, over 30 years, where one of the things they now have is a master's program. And it's called, it's really, they have a couple of master's programs. The one I know best is designed for teachers. It's for teachers in indigenous communities, but it's also for people from different types of organizations. They have an intake each year of about 60 students. They meet together once a month. It's kind of, on an intensive basis. And they set out, right at the start of the master's program. It's a 2 years master's course. They say, what we are trying to do is look at education from the perspective of la digna rabia, of dignified rage, this zapatista term. How do we think about education? How do we think about the practice of teachers in primary schools and secondary schools and in nursery schools? How do we think about that from the perspective of la digna rabia? How do we think about it from the perspective of trying to change society radically? This is a program, I think it's not very well known outside Tepe Shishuk. No, it is actually fairly well known now. It gets students from about 10 different states. But one of the fantastic things, I suppose, about Mexico or about Latin America is you kind of scratch the surface, and you suddenly realize these things are going on all over the place. And they've been going on for years, and people have been dedicating their lives to them, and they've been doing fantastic things. They've been rethinking not only the aim of education, but the whole question of how you think about education. They've been rethinking kind of education as part of the process of struggle. And that seems to me, fantastic. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we need to do, what we need to spread. The relation there between institutions and non-institutions, I suppose, is complicated, because in some cases, Nunitierra is very kind of anti-institutional, which I like a lot. But you also have to recognize that for a lot of people, me too. I work within a university institution. So the challenge is how within that institutional context do you actually say from the start what we're doing here, what we're going to do in the postgrad or the sociologia in my case, or the postgraduate program of sociology, what we're interested in is really an education that starts from la digna rabia, our fury against the system exists. How do we actually think about education from there, even if we are in an institutional context? And I think that's happening an awful lot. It's kind of interesting that at the same time as you get this terrible neoliberalization of the universities in the whole world, that at the same time there's these pockets of resistance appearing, where people are saying, no, that's not what education is about. Education has to be about changing the world. Education has to be about saving humanity, I suppose, from its own self-destruction.
For audios of John Holloway's complete lectures in San Francisco, check in on our website, radioautonomia.wordpress.com. For more information about his work, visit his website, johnholloway.com.mx.